I want to take a minute and talk about ShopBoss. It's the ultimate solution for automotive shop management. In fact, the founder was a former shop owner himself. He was an industry guy with coding knowledge and experience who built what he wished existed for his own shop. Let's not forget about their customer service, because it truly is second to none. They've invested in the people and the processes, ensuring that you receive top-notch service every step of the way. Say goodbye to the hassle of managing separate sets of books. Everything you need is built right in. ShopBoss also offers built-in DVI functionality, eliminating the need for third-party solutions. Plus, with profit per hour, maximize your profit on every job sold, ensuring that advisors, techs, and owners are all working together to make each job profitable. And with customizable real-time reporting on the owner's dashboard, gain valuable insights into your business at a glance. Experience the power of ShopBoss today and see why thousands of shop owners trust them to simplify their operations, drive success, and run their business like a boss. My name is Jimmy Purdy, shop owner, master tech, transmission builder, and the host of the Gearbox Podcast. Here I talk with new and seasoned shop owners, as well as industry professionals, about day-to-day operations within their own shops and all the failures and successes that come along the way. From what grinds your gears to having to shift gears in the automotive industry, this is the Gearbox Podcast. Are you just starting a shop? Is that right?
Yeah, so I've been in business for 2 years now.
Okay.
And it's been a rocky road.
Yeah.
But all of this past year, I've just spent learning business, learning numbers. After my first 6 months of business, I quickly found out I cannot run a business like this.
Yeah. So, well, you can't afford to.
No,
I mean, you
not
could,
at all.
But you can't. You can do it like that, but you're not going to afford it very long.
No, definitely not. Yeah, it was the first 6 months, that's for sure.
What's your biggest takeaway in that time, right? So, like, you start out, and it's so interesting, like, I don't know, there's so many huge changes that happen in, like, the first few years, even. I mean, I'm not that seasoned, so even in the first decade, there's just so much that changes, but it seems like everything starts getting kind of smaller and smaller and smaller. You don't have these big epiphanies anymore. What was, like, a big takeaway in the first 6 months for you?
Man, where do I start?
It's too many.
There's so many. There's so many.
I know. It's exciting, though, you know? That's like the motivating thing.
Yeah. Yeah, the biggest epiphany for me was probably, you know, you always hear you have to charge more. You always hear you need to make money on parts. You always hear you're not charging enough and all of those things. But it doesn't always click until one point. And I read The E-Myth, and that's when it all clicked. And I was like,
that's a good book.
You know, I'm understanding why I need to charge for parts. I'm understanding that I'm not just a technician anymore. And when you start a shop, you're only billing for the labor hours. Well, that only pays the technician. So how do you wrap your head around how you're paying for your time? Even as a one person shop, I'm still multiple employees in that shop. Well, how do I pay for my time of doing the calls to the customers? How do I get paid for the time that I spend into estimates? Because some estimates you can spend a long time on, especially if it's not a job you've done before. So how do you pay for that parts person, that service tech, that, you know, you're the manager in the shop? How do you pay for that time if you're only billing for labor hours for the technician?
That's a huge thing to get right off the bat, really, because I think we don't value ourselves enough. That's like the biggest thing in the industry is like technicians turn shop owners. We just don't think we're an invaluable shop owner. We're a great technician and we don't mind charging, you know, our tech rate is, but we don't deserve shop owner. We're not a shop owner. We're not a leader. And it's like in the back of your mind, it's like yelling at you. So you try to put this big number for your hourly labor rate and you're like, oh, I can probably whittle that down a little bit. I can probably charge a little bit. Right. And it's like, but how do you replace those four or five different positions that you're taking over? It's like that for me, like, I relate to that because it's like, wait a second. If I need to hire somebody to answer the phones the way I want the phones answered, I can't I gotta pay them. They're not going to do it for free, and they're not going to be happy about it like I am unless they're paid what they want to be paid.
Right. Yeah. And I think that as shop owners starting out, if you were a technician, odds are you became a technician because you had to work on your own stuff because you didn't want to pay for a shop where you couldn't pay for a shop.
Right.
So I think that a lot of times we go into it with the mentality of we'll help them, we'll be cheaper. And boy, does that get you in a lot of trouble.
What an interesting takeaway. That's an interesting thought because it's exactly what it is too. I mean, I don't think there's but maybe 2% that are like, you know, it's a good investment, auto repair, you know? And you go into it, it's just like an investor, like,
it's
you know,
a horrible investment.
Yeah, like out of all the businesses that I could own and franchise, I think I'm going to take my life savings and invest it in opening an auto repair shop. It's like, no, I don't think so. Yep. It's like you said, you start fixing your own and you're like, hey, I'm kind of decent at this and everybody needs me. And, you know, and it does take a special mind to be able to, you know, take that kind of stress and fix a vehicle. And you're like, hey, I can do this. You start making money. You're like, I should probably get a shop. That makes sense. Just seems like the natural progression. And then all of us.
Yeah. And you think like, oh, I'm going to make $100 an hour. I'm going to make $120 an hour and up. And then you don't think of the expense of it. There's so much expense when you're trying to do it proper. Man, it is not cheap, and it you don't realize it until you're in it, and you're like, I need to learn my numbers quick.
Yeah, because you can't keep just charging more to make up the difference, right? It's not like a big pile that you can just keep throwing money at it. You know, it's like you're just burning it at that point, and now you're going to burn yourself out of the area because there's always someone doing it cheaper,
always, you
know? And always doing better, and it's like so hard.
And like you can't just keep raising your rates without knowing why you're raising your rates.
No, that's
because
a good point,
then you end up getting in your feelings and you're like, oh, you know what, I could probably do that for less, or you feel bad about sending the estimate, and you can't sell it if you don't feel good about it.
Absolutely.
Like that, I think that goes through to the customer and they feel that also.
Oh yeah, emotional discounting is a huge one, but exactly, not having the confidence. You know, whether it's you selling it or you have a service advisor that you have working for you, like that confidence bleeds to them, whether it's him or her, right? And it's like, if you're not confident in the number you're putting them to put down on paper to call the client, they're not going to be confident. And it's a good point to bring up too, because it's like, so how do you feel confident in that sale? What do you have to do besides just looking at the numbers? Sure, you run the numbers and you're like, okay, so I calculate this out. You know, and I got to be at 178.39 cents an hour, right? However your calculation comes to it. But then you look at that number and it still goes back to square one. Could I afford to do that? I couldn't afford to put a transmission in this vehicle for $6,000. Well, it's not your pocket. You're not paying for it, man.
Right.
You don't know what's going on in their life. And it doesn't, not that it doesn't matter, but it doesn't really matter. Yep. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
And so it's hard.
A lot of times we care too much. You know, we didn't design the car. And when you hear technicians say that all the time, I didn't design the car. It's not my responsibility to keep it running. But I think as shop owners, most of the time we want to help people. And you see that big number. And if you don't know why that big number is what that big number is, you don't feel good about selling it. And if you don't know why you're charging what you're charging, I just think that's a bad path to go down, really.
Oh yeah. I mean, how can you feel good about that? You know, and so your technician background, how did that start out for you? How did you end up in the industry?
I've been a little bit everywhere. So I started off going to college, Elizabethtown Community College, and they taught me, it was for automotive technology. So that's where I learned about scopes and diagnosing cars. They had a drivability test there drivability class. And they would drive in bugged cars. And if you fixed them, you passed. If you didn't, you failed.
That's how that class went.
Do what?
A bugged car? Is that what you said?
Yeah. Yeah. The instructors would bug the car. So you'd have to pull it in there and diagnose what's wrong with it. There'd be classroom stuff, you know.
Not like a tracker, not like the CIA watching you. Like they would disconnect. They would like disconnect this. I was like, you're taking me back to my smog days a little bit. I'm like, what are we talking about here?
Right, right.
So disconnect the sensor or sabotage it in a better sense of the word.
Or switch the wiring around on the harness or something like that.
That's pretty cool.
Make you dig into it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And that's where I got my start, because I went there. I was already mud bogging and doing some off-roading stuff in high school. So I went to college to learn the sensors and everything on the electric side of the car, because I was messing with carburetors and doing all of that stuff. And when it came to sensors and computers, I was lost and I just had to know how to do it. So I went to college for that. And then after college, I tried getting on at different dealerships and independent shops. Well, at that point, I'd only had the experience I've had as a hobby, not professional. Nobody wanted to hire me. So I went and tried getting on. Well, they would get me on as like a lube tech, but I don't know what they were starting at, like $8 or $9 an hour back then. So I went to being a heavy equipment mechanic in a mine because they started me out at $14 an hour. So I went there, worked on heavy equipment, became a diesel mechanic, and that same thing transferred over to mining equipment. They used sensors on the drills to calibrate where they're going to drill into the walls and all of that. So I did that, left there, went to a fleet garage working on semis. And there I was the diagnostic tech for all of the after treatment stuff. So everything with SCRs and DPFs, all the emission stuff on diesels. We worked on reefer units. I became a 608 certified for reefer units. And while I was working at the fleet garage in the mine, I always worked on cars at home, ran my side business, and that side business ended up becoming a full-time business. After I left the fleet garage, because it was a second shift job and I worked a lot of hours. I was going through problems in my personal life, ended up going through a divorce, left there, went to work at a dealership. And after working at the dealership for about 3 months, when the divorce was final, I opened up my shop full-time. And that's the position that I was in.
Just dove right in.
Yeah. So yeah, I was starting the shop before the divorce, and the divorce hit like weeks before opening date of the shop. So had to replan things. And yeah, I've been a shop owner ever since.
So transitioning from the heavy equipment or the mining field into like the civilian, I guess you'd call it, mm-hmm. auto repair. You said you did it a lot on the side, but as far as formal training or like getting into the auto repair, is that just you had a knack for it? Or was it something you've always wanted to do more versus than going down the route with the heavy equipment?
Yeah, I've always wanted to be automotive.
Okay.
For my training in automotive, when I went to diesel equipment, not to make any diesel guys mad, but it wasn't that in depth. Like the automotive technology is really in depth, and diesel stuff now, yeah, they're getting some sensors and they're being more technologically advanced. But as far as the heavy equipment went, there wasn't that much thinking that had to be done. It was all just big, get dirty, work hard stuff.
Yeah. Heavy, pretty obvious when it's broken.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then the semis we worked on, I worked in a fleet and they got rid of them at 750,000 miles. And those semis, they just run for 750,000 miles. Like there's not much that goes wrong with them except for the after treatment stuff. So that's why I went into that, because it was more reading scan tools and digging in deep on electronics. I like doing that stuff. That's what I've always been, is the diagnosing kind of guy.
I see.
Yeah.
So when you pivoted into your shop, is that what you tried to specialize in? How was your first kind of year of like sifting through everything, right? Like eventually everything comes out in the wash, and at the end of a couple of years you realize, okay, well, I guess this is what my shop's going to do. But was there a direction you tried to push it?
I tried to push it towards diag.
Okay.
And as our industry is famously done, we've never charged properly for diag.
Yep.
And man, did it hurt me. Mm-hmm. And I had to reevaluate how I was doing things, how I was charging for it. And that's what I advertise the most. You know, when you open up a shop and you're advertising, you get what you ask for. And I was asking for diag stuff. I was advertising that I could diagnose things. Shops were sending me things. There was cars coming from 3 hours away that nobody else could figure out. And I spent so much time on them problem cars that it really just, it broke the bank. You know,
isn't that sad state of affairs though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, time. Like that, it just takes a different individual to have the confidence, and then for two, the tenacity to stay after it and know what you're looking at, right? For one.
Yeah.
And then cause there ain't no book for that. Like you can't, hey, what's the sensor? No. What's the range? I mean, you can look up ohm specs or whatever, but we all know that's just nothing. I mean, everyone's looked through a flow chart and like, yeah, this is garbage. Like this doesn't help anybody do anything when it comes to a complicated problem. Right. And it just blows
me
away.
Look at flow charts.
Sure. It's great to get in the habit of like going through a process. That's it. Yeah. Like not even the process that they're showing you, but just like, if you're not good with going through a process, that's about all it teaches you. Like,
like I didn't even know that flow charts were a thing until like a year ago, because in college, my instructor, John Chisholm, he always throw out plugs toward him, but he didn't teach us no flow charts. He didn't teach us with Identifix. He didn't teach us with any of that. You either passed or you failed. And I've never used a flow chart. Sometimes I look at them now just as a reference for some stuff, because sometimes you need a spec and it's in that flow chart.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's useful, but.
And sometimes you get so caught up in your own head that you just need like somewhere to hold on a second here. I feel like I'm in the town like 10 miles over and I need to get back to home base here for a second.
Oh yeah.
How did I end up over here?
You just start spinning circles.
Right. Right. But on that point of like knowing how to do that, it's so much mental. It's like, and we're just not paid enough for that. And it's just crazy. It's a crazy thing. And it's always something that I think about when it comes to some of the other shops, right? And you get the parts cannon.
Yeah.
Or the parts changer, right?
Yep.
We'll give a plug to Mr. Paul Danner and like, don't be a parts changer. But you look at that situation and you have a repair that costs $1,000 to the client. It's $1,000. They don't care how you got there. Was it $900 in parts and $100 labor, or was it $900 labor and $100 in parts? Right.
Right.
Doesn't matter. Car was fixed for $1,000.
Yep.
We both know which way it should have been fixed.
Right.
Right. That $900 should be going to a skilled labor, not supporting. And I love Dorman, but not supporting Dorman Standard or anybody else. Right.
I just made a TikTok on Dorman.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and so like supporting that and putting the money where it needs to go and taking the time is like, but it's such a difficult conversation. And I'm sure that's something you go through too, as well as like trying to educate the client. And it's like, like, how do you process that situation too? You're a high level diag guy. So how do you communicate that process to try to get that money for that diag?
Well, it's hard to paint a picture that no one else paints the picture of. So what I started doing was I started making videos and putting them on YouTube and putting them on TikTok, and I'll use them as a reference. I'll explain to them every diag that I do, it's not going to be cheap. I do more of a retainer style, like what Scanner Danner has put out there as an idea. I have three levels of diag, and I use four levels of diag, and I use them four levels as how many systems do I think that I'll have to diagnose on this car? If you have a misfire, I can already suspect that I would have to diagnose ignition and fuel. So I do that by 2 hours. And then if it's something that, say, is a problem car that other shops couldn't figure out, I just go ahead and say it's going to take 4 hours. So I charge 4 hours of my diagnostic rate, which my diagnostic rate is a time and a half of what my shop rate is. And that's just kind of what I've started using now. And it's helped tremendously more than what I've used before, trying to do hour by hour. But I let them know, you know, you can look and see what my diagnostic procedures are on YouTube and TikTok. And whenever I diagnose your car, you'll have everything sent to you in a DVI. So I take videos of the tests that I do with a description of what that means. And all the work that I do, all the testing, you will get. It's not that you just have to pay $400 and you just think that I plugged up to it and said that you need a new intake.
Right.
That's not the way this is going to go. So I think it's more just establishing trust, and that's the way that I've tried to go with it. And I tried to establish trust through transparency.
Yeah, and, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, I think the pictures and the videos are always great.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you really want to be the devil's advocate, you could say, well, you just have a portfolio of pictures and videos that you send out, right? Like, sure. Yeah, that's what I do.
Right.
But I think
so whenever I do it, like I'll take a video and show the actual car.
Yeah, that's smart.
Things like that to show that it is yours. But the main thing that I try to drive home is just trust. And I mean, I'm a new business owner. I'm learning. I may be doing all the wrong things. Who knows? But so far it's worked and people have really enjoyed that. I send the videos and pictures. They say, wow, no other shop has ever done this.
Right. Well, and it's like that, like I said, it's not like that's a standard, but there's definitely a 1%, right?
Yeah.
And you're in the 1%, right? As far as these top shop owners that are doing things differently.
Yep.
But you don't see that, right? Because you're in your shop. You're not in anybody else's shop. So you're just constantly doing and evolving and trying to keep it more and more and more detail oriented. And you don't realize you make a small mistake. Like no one noticed that because you're already at such a high level. Like, yeah, you might've slipped up. You made a mistake there, but it's like everything else you're doing is like, you're so far divorced from what everybody else in quotes is doing. Right. But on the note of like that diagnostic thing, the problem I have is you get into the point where you have a few technicians, maybe more than you can manage or really pay attention to, and you get this diagnostic rate, and now it becomes an SOP. So you're charging $400 for this misfire diagnostic, or I like to call it an advanced assessment. I don't like using the word diagnostic, but regardless of that, you have these billable hours that are being charged, and you get down to the last bit of it, and hey, boss, I didn't really find anything. Everything looks good, and come to find out, it had low compression, right? And it's like something that should have been checked off in the first 5 minutes.
Right.
You know, and I think that's a big problem when it comes to the diagnostic stuff. It's like a gut punch, right?
Yep.
Especially someone in your shoes that takes pride in your diagnostic capabilities, and you hire somebody and this technician is high level and he does a great job. And then all of a sudden just misses the mark. And now that $400, like, how do you explain to the client, look, so we found out you have low compression, you charge and it's going to cost you $400, $500, $600. That's a tough conversation, you know, it's like, and it's like, how do you backpedal from something like that?
I honestly think that with something like that, it's just, how do you sleep good at night?
Yeah.
You know, so I'll start and say, okay, it'll be $400 for me to diagnose your car. And it's happened to me before. I skipped over one. I did a relative compression check on. There's even a YouTube video out on it. And I counted all the cylinders, and it was 8 cylinder, and there was only 7 compression strokes.
Right.
And for some reason, I counted 8, and I continued on and chased my tail, and it had a dead cylinder the whole time. And what I did with that client was I just didn't charge them that whole amount. I charged them what I thought that I should charge them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, people make mistakes. It's just, you know, that's another thing with shop owners. It's like everybody makes mistakes. It's what are you going to do about it that makes you good or not? And
it's a fair point.
I've chased money for my whole life. And after divorce, money ain't the most valuable thing. So,
yeah, isn't that like the biggest, most calming thought? And I think, I mean, it helps to have a little bit of money to relax. So once you get like, once you get a little bit in the bank, it's easy to sit here and say, oh, you know, just relax. The first couple of years when you're like, you know, hey, I got, you know, $2,500 in the account right now, and I got a $2,000 payroll coming up and then rent. And it's the last week of the month. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And then everyone starts calling out sick, and you're like, what am I going to do? But you get through it, and then you're like, it's cool. You know, it's like, but man, like, you're just.
That's the life I've been living right there. Just, you know, I think I got $2,500 in the bank right now. And it's like, I don't know how much parts bills are coming up. Like, I got to look at that. There's probably 2,000 coming out, but I still think, you know, just the way that my life has went, money's not the most valuable thing.
Yeah. It's
I've made really good money, and I've made really bad money. time with my kids is the most valuable thing. So if it means that I just got to knock off a little bit, so I feel good about, I wouldn't say misdiagnosing, but chasing my tail longer than I should have, it is what it is.
Yeah. It's tough. And as the years go on, you just have to try to manage it more closely, you know, and try to put more systems in place to ensure that doesn't happen again, because you can't become a pattern. Right. And so really detailed and almost asinine procedures that I've put in place where it's like, hey, if a car comes in for a crank, no start, this is what we do. But yes. This is what we do. Like,
yes. Every time something eats, like every time that I have to eat something, new SOP.
Yeah, absolutely.
New policy.
It's the smartest way to do it. What are you going to do? You're going to go through that again and have it hurt you again? It's like fool me twice, right? Like be smart enough to like write it down and take 5 minutes out of your day to say, hey, look, that hurt, right?
Yeah.
Let's not let that happen again.
Yeah.
And some of the guys some of the guys I've hired is like, they look at these sheets, is like, what do I need this for? Is like, trust me, you know?
Yeah.
And I've even had people in my, technicians I've hired come in and I have an employee handbook and everything's written out. It's all detailed, like what's expected. And it's, 10, 15 pages long, and it gets a page longer every year. Right. And I've had one guy's like, oh, you've been burned before, huh? I'm like, why do you say that? He's like, oh, I was just reading through the handbook and I can tell you've been burned before. I'm like, I hope it's pretty apparent there. Like, that's why I put all that in there. It's like, because I don't want this to happen again. I want to make sure we're very, very clear about what's expected from each other. Not just me being a dictator and you coming, showing up and getting a paycheck, but like, what you should expect from me as well. Right. Like, that's important.
Yeah.
Guys don't want to work somewhere and be like, have questions about any of that or not know what to ask or when to ask. It's like, it's a lot.
Right.
What are you going to do? Have that conversation, that lengthy conversation with every single body you hire? That's crazy.
Right.
Write it down and then have them read it. You need to read this. This is really important.
Right. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. The technician SOPs and throughout the whole shop. I mean, and I see it a lot too with shops in the area or shops I visit where, they're constantly yelling. It's constantly yelling, constantly saying the same thing over and over. Constantly locking the keys in the car. Like, why do you lock the key? Well, the guys always forget to roll the windows down when they pull it into the shop. Like, so write it down and have a meeting and have everybody read it. And then give them that when you pull a car in the shop, the window goes down. Like, stuff as simple as that.
Always.
It just blows me away that it's like, that's not covered, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And this whole time, while I'm a one-man show, I'm like, I'm making policies on everything that eats me and writing it down. And I forget which book it was that I read, and they talked about how McDonald's is a franchise and franchising your business, making it to where everybody that's under you can follow this script and have the same outcome every time. And I took note of that. So now every time that something happens, I just make a new policy and write it down. New standard operating procedure, and I just write it down every time.
Yeah. And it's another one of those easier said than done.
Yeah.
Between actually writing it down, then actually implementing it, and then actually having people read it and follow it.
Yeah, I haven't got there yet.
that's where the management comes in. That's a whole nother thing of like actually having a manager that's on board that wants to follow and they want to listen to them. And it's like a whole freaking like, oh my God, I thought, you think you just write it down and people would like follow it like the Bible, but they don't realize the struggles you've been through or going through, And you're like, dude, this is important. They're like, why? I don't care. I get my paycheck. I mean, not that
bad. Yeah,
like
you got to tell them the story so they know how bad you got burned.
Right. And hopefully they care enough to actually like care about it. They're like, well, that sucks. It happened to you.
Right.
Not saying that they're all bad, but I mean, it's smart. I mean, that was something I never did in the first few years. It was like, you just show up. And for me, it was like working. It's like I just make sure to dedicate every hour I got. Like, and I start realizing it's like, why does it feel like I get the same amount of money in the bank, whether I'm there for 5 hours or I'm there for 10 hours, you know? And it's like, if I can like cut my time at the shop in half, then my take home per hour goes up. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like,
yep. I know exactly what you mean. Like,
why is it? It's just, you're not making any more by pushing yourself to be there, but you want to. You know, it's like you got this yeah. weird urge or something of like, you just need to make sure you're there all the time. You're the first one in and the last one out all the time. Work harder. Yep. Work harder. Nobody cares. It's like,
yep, more cars.
Yeah, the car count, right? Like,
oh man,
how much does the car count really matter? It's like, does it really right. matter, or do you focus on your ARO or what's? And it's yeah, I've had plenty of other friends open shops where they're like, I just need as many cars, and they're just going around all the tow yards. Hey, send me all the yeah. cars. Like, bro, why do you want that work?
Right.
You know? And not to say what you're doing, but why would you want all the diagnostic work? Like,
I advertise brakes now.
Yeah. So you learn though. And it's like, you're not yeah, beating exactly. your head against the wall, you know? And it's like,
exactly.
It's like, take a step back. And how were you able to take a step back and see that? I mean, what was that epiphany for you to realize maybe I'm not going down the right path?
My epiphany happened after 6 months of opening the shop. So after 6 months, it was Christmas time. And, you know, I was just more cars, get the work done, fix more cars. And then it hit me. I was $14,000 in debt and I couldn't afford to get my kids much for Christmas. And I don't ever want to feel that again. So that's why all of 2023, I just stayed on ASOG and stayed on changing the industry and talked to everybody and learned business, learned how I was doing things wrong. When I started, I was running all of my shop management software through ALLDATA, basically using it to do estimates and things like that. And I developed, I got Techmetric now. I use Techmetric, better SMS. I learned what parts tech was and sped up my process doing all that. And then after that, it was all just learning numbers. Like you said, ARO, gross profit per hour, just everything that you need to learn financially about owning an automotive business has been my priority for all of 2023. It wasn't about car count. I just needed enough to pay the bills. You know, I just advertised enough to get the work to pay the bills and focused on working on the business instead of in the business.
And how does your ego take that? I mean, as far as you having this vision to be the best diagnostic shop and then coming to terms with like, that's not realistic.
Yeah.
And making that pivot, right?
It doesn't pay to be a hero. That's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, like it has to make business sense or you shouldn't do it. Like I still do some custom work. There's a lot of people that will turn away all the custom work. I work on old hot rods. I'll lift some trucks, things like that. But because of the extra time spent, I've been adjusting it too, just like I do the diagnostic work. It's a higher labor rate. You have to evolve or you're going to go out of business.
Yeah. And then there's part of it too, where if there's no work, that's better than no work, right?
Yeah.
But you also don't want to do that high level work with a terrible ELR, an effective labor rate on it. If
right.
the next day you're going to have some gravy work come in, right? That's going to have right. a big profit margin. So sometimes you get stuck in that rut where, well, I don't really have anything going on today. I don't know what's coming in tomorrow. And someone comes in, hey, you want to lift this thing for me or whatever?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh man, I don't really make that much money, but I got nothing going on. So you take it in anyway. And then
breaks come.
Four in a row, right? The next day.
And like then
the
you next... can't do them because the lift's full.
Right. And like the lift kit that your buddy brought in with this truck is wrong. And now you're waiting a week because you got the thing torn apart. And I mean, how many times have you been in that situation where it's like, I should have just said no.
So I did this lift kit and the customer was great. He was understanding about the whole thing and I didn't make bad profit on it. But so I took on this lift kit and it already had a lift kit on the truck. I took the lift kit off. Somebody had cut off all of the control arm brackets on the bottom for that lift kit. So the new lift kit that I got bolted up to them control arm brackets. Mm-hmm. So then now that 2-day turnaround job turned into a 2-week turnaround job because now everything that I took off, I had to cut off with a torch because it was a nightmare rust situation. I had to go to the junkyard and get the brackets off of the other frames and put it back on this frame and weld it all up. I wouldn't have took on that job if I wasn't a good welder and fabricator. Like that is not a job that somebody should just do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was to the point that like it was just cut off. truck up on the lift, nothing hanging off of the frame. Like, it wasn't a good situation. But I explained it all to the customer, showed good pictures, sent it all through the DVI, and told him that we would have to fabricate it back up. And he understood, and he understood charging more for it. But that's another good example of what you just said. Like, you take on that lift kit because you're slow. And for the time that I worked on that lift kit and fixing the frame back and finishing it up, I could have done several brake jobs and made more money.
Yeah, it's like, how do you even charge for that, to be fair, right? Like,
right.
Because, yeah, you can't compensate that rack time. There's no way. But then also, what are you going to charge this guy? $8,000 to do this lift kit? You know, and right. And then you always have that in the back of your mind. And you want to make sure you stay profitable. You want to do the right thing. But then they go asking around, hey, man, he charged me like $8,000 to do that. How much would you? And it's like, everyone's, oh, man, that's way too much, you know?
Right.
And so you always,
they don't know the whole story. And it's like whenever people go window shopping, like they'll go asking for a brake job over here, over there, then they come to you. Well, you're not getting the same thing with those estimates.
Absolutely.
You know, if somebody says a brake job for your car for $150, that's not the same as the person that's charging $500 for your front axle for brakes, but giving you a 3-year warranty with it.
Right.
It's not the same at all.
With the proper parts, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Brand new rotors, right?
Right.
I mean, nice stuff. Actually, you know, cleaning the slide pins and re-lubricating them and all the standard practice stuff that we know of, but there's actually shops out there and guys out there that don't care to do that. You know, they pull one pin out, they swivel the caliper up, they slap the pads on, they slap it back down, and they're done in 25 minutes.
And leave the rotor on it. Yeah.
Don't even worry about the rotor, you know, or even, you know, like just on the car brake lathe real quick. I mean, hopefully they're at least doing that, but it's crazy, like the amount and like the spectrum of how these repairs go and how that's so unknown to a client, you know, even though they can go get a cheeseburger at McDonald's, right? Or then get a cheeseburger at Ruth's Chris, right? And it's like, you're going to say that's the same? It's a cheeseburger, right?
Right. Yeah.
You sure it's the same? Yeah.
And I like the analogy of the people wanting to bring their own cheeseburger and them just cook it.
Yeah.
I like that analogy when it comes to bringing your own parts. I've gotten ate by that a lot too. So I had a customer bring a used transmission to me.
Oh.
I won't do used transmissions anymore. and I won't do used parts anymore.
I don't blame you. There's no reason to do that, you know.
Nope.
I don't
first 6 months of business.
I don't think there's ever a situation where that ends up going right. It just
no. Never.
Never. And even
and then I'm not a transmission specialist like you are or were. I'm not that guy. And at first I was taking apart transmissions because, I mean, I learned about them and I've rebuilt some old 350s, 400s, stuff like that, some manual transmissions. But after you take apart a couple of them and you get it to work again, but then the next time you put it in reverse, it don't have reverse, you just stop doing that. I don't even open transmissions. I do a direct replacement. Or there's a great transmission specialist that's like an hour from me and I'll refer you to them.
Yeah. Like, I think I might be a little on the spectrum because for some reason when that happens to me, I just need to get back in and figure out what I did wrong. But I think there's something wrong with me. That's why it worked once. Why not again? I'm pulling it back out. I'm going back into it. Like, are you serious? I think a lot of people would have just given up.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but.
I had a Dodge Dart that sat here for like 4 months because I would pull it in when I'm slow and mess with it and kick it back out. And it was like, I just stopped charging the customer. He was up to $1,000. He got all the stuff that I needed or all the stuff that, you know, I had already done. But at that point, I was just too invested. I just brought it back in, like you said. And I was like, well, I mean, it's not going to do you any good sitting in your yard. So just leave it here and I'll keep tinkering with it.
Yeah.
Finally, I threw in the towel. It's the only one that's got away.
Yeah. I mean, it happens. You know, it's just the odds of percentages. It's like comes a point in time, there's not enough time or not enough money to spend on it. And we all have one, you know, I don't care who you are. You're listening right now. You have a car that kicked your ass and you weren't able to figure out. Guarantee it.
Yep.
But I think starting as a shop owner and like you think you're going to fix everything, you know, and you let that one eat you up so much. It's not even worth it. And it's like, you look back, you're like, why don't even the client didn't care as much as you did, you know?
Yeah, that's how this was. He didn't care that much.
Like, you cared more than he did. He's like, dude, it's not a big deal. Seriously, like, I'm just going to sell this thing. Like, no, I can figure this out. Yeah. Don't get rid of it. And you're like,
When he came to pick it up, like, he paid for the $1,000 for the DAG, but he was so appreciative of all the time that I spent on it. And yeah, I valued fixing that more than he did.
Yeah,
for sure. For sure.
It just becomes a mental challenge for you to like figure it out, you know?
Once I'm so invested, I got to know. It still eats at me every day.
Yeah.
So I network with another guy, and he's another good DAG guy here. He just started a shop about the same time I did. And every time one kicks our butt, we're always Snapchatting each other what's kicking our butt. And he just sent me one the other day, and it was a, what was it, a Jeep. He had just worked on a Jeep, put a flex plate back on it, and he put the flex plate on 180 out. He found it that it had, what is it? There's 15 on the cam crank correlation. On the crank wavelength, there's 15 wavelengths, and then it pauses and goes to 16. And he found out that he mounted that thing 180 out.
Wow.
And he sent me that after it kicked his butt and he couldn't figure it out forever. He sent that to me in a Snapchat and was like, do you think that's what happened to that dart? And I was like, that dart's out of my mind, dude. Don't even bring it up.
Don't even bring it. You're going to call him up. Hey, you want to bring your car back down? No, I don't want to spend any money on it. No, just bring it down. I'm going to do it for free. What? Yeah. Now, that's the weirdest call anybody's ever gotten. Hey, this guy wants the car back to fix for free. I don't understand that at all. Yeah. Well, I mean, and how important is networking on that point too, though? Like,
that's all I've done all year is network.
I mean, and it's like, how big is that and how much that is so underrated? And everyone we're in competition with each other, right? Like, you know, that's your competition down the street. Like, what are you talking about? Dude, there's more cars than we would ever be able to fix on our own in our lifetime. And why is this like a competition thing? Why are we chasing ourselves to the bottom of a barrel with our pricing? Yeah.
Wow. I network with everybody around here. I just reached out to a mobile mechanic today. He's tagged a whole bunch in one of the Facebook groups, and I reached out to him. And I always tell everybody whenever I reach out, you know, I don't believe in competition. The gas stations that make the most money are right beside each other.
Yeah.
The ones that are out by themselves always go out of business.
That's true.
So I don't believe in any competition. Like you said, there's cars out there for everybody. So I network with everybody, and I tell everybody about ASOG and changing the industry and all of the Facebook groups that what I believe all the great owners are in.
Yeah. You know? Like I said, it's definitely a 1%, and it's even as big as these groups have become and are becoming, it's we're big numbers here, right? And it's only 1%. So there's so many more out there.
Yeah.
And maybe they are on the same page, maybe they aren't, but it is kind of mind blowing to see how many other shop owners and how many other shops, how many out there, how many technicians are out there to staff these shops. And then to say there's a technician shortage, I don't know. I don't know if I'm really bought into that. I definitely think there's a lack of leadership. There's a lack of proper owners. Sure. And a lot of guys getting out of the industry because they just, you know, they go to 10 or 15 different shops and they realize, man, this is just how all shops are ran. I don't like this anymore, because the shops they're looking for are the ones in the 1%.
Yes.
It's a drop in the bucket. It's very difficult for them to network and get in communication with the shop they're looking for. Now, granted, there's plenty of guys that don't want that. They just, you know, and it doesn't matter. You don't have to change everybody's attitude, but I feel like there's a lot of pull of technicians, managers that want a better shop. They want somewhere to work where someone cares enough to advance their opportunities and advance the industry as a whole and feel like you're doing something. I mean, it's the reason why we fix cars, right? It's like to make a difference, you know, and there's nothing better than taking a car that comes in off the hook and then driving it down the street when you're done with it.
Right. I mean, agree 100%. After starting up my shop, if I found a shop around me that was in that 1%, I wouldn't be an owner.
Right.
It's difficult.
It is. And it's, well, what's harder, you know, doing it on your own or finding that 1% shop owner?
Oh, it's way easier finding the 1% shop.
Maybe. I don't know.
For sure.
The needle in the haystack. I mean, realistically, it right. seems like when yeah. we're all surrounded in these groups and we all talk and we have these conversations, it seems like this is our world and this is how it is, but it's not. It's such a small, it's such a small bubble that we're in. For most, it's really difficult. And even though, you know, we see it on our feed all the time and we're always talking about it and we always see it and are actively playing a role in it, it's not the reality for most.
Right.
And it kind of sucks. And I can see why a lot of guys will just venture out on their own. I mean, for me, it was to get out of a bad environment and to build a shop where I could advance technicians. I could hire someone with a mindset like me and advance their career and pay them more than I was ever paid. And one of the biggest yeah. hurdles for me was getting a technician in and paying him more than I was ever paid as a technician. You know, and then right. realizing, wow, this is working. Like,
yeah,
we're both profiting, but he's making more yeah. than I ever did.
That's what I did. So I got a helper right now, and he's a real good friend of mine, and he was actually my biggest customer the last couple of years. And
well,
he mows grass. He owns a grass mowing business, and he's not a mechanic, but you know, he's been poor-ish before. You know, he worked on a lot of cars, so he's helping me out. And I don't have enough car count and I don't have enough income to figure out how much I can pay somebody hourly. Right now, for me, it's a roller coaster. I'll be busy as heck and then I'll have no cars. And then I'm busy as heck and I'll have no cars. So right now I'm paying him flat rate, but he's using my tools. I got two toolboxes stocked up and I'm paying him $35 an hour flat rate. And that's more money than I've ever made flat rate. Around here, you don't really get that much money flat rate. So, yeah, I definitely relate to that. And I want to be that shop that is the environment for technicians. You know, right now, my shop is AC and heated. And that's unheard of around here. And I want to keep it that way. You said something about the power of networking. So I've been networking. And I've been networking with different business owners and other industries also.
Absolutely.
One of them is an electrician. And because I networked with him, he bought a property for his business and he built a shop on it. He messaged me and he was like, "Hey, I built you a shop. It's going to be this much a month." Okay, sweet. So I'm moving into a shop and it's cheaper than anything else that I could find. And it's all because I networked with him.
Yeah. Yeah,
so networking is a huge, powerful tool.
Just show up, be there, do the things. It's amazing how yeah. many opportunities present themselves if you just get up and go to these things, you know, whether it's a chamber yeah. of commerce mixer or a city meeting in the morning. Like there's so many things that you can get to that doesn't cost you a dime. I think one of my biggest marketing one was when I was doing jiu-jitsu. I was going to the dojo. I'd go after work and go roll. Right. I picked up so many clients from that gym. It just blew me away. Right. And I didn't even think about it. Like I was going there for myself. And so I tried to keep, like, I don't want to talk about cars. Cause as soon as you start talking about it, everybody has yeah. something, right? Everywhere you yeah. go. Right.
Always.
I just didn't realize like in a jiu-jitsu gym, it's kind of expensive. And so most of the guys are either correctional officers or CHP or police officers, or they're usually high ranking individuals in the community and they can afford this, you know, repairs. I mean, of course, at the time I didn't think about it that way, but once I started realizing, started coming into the shop, I'm like, oh, I should probably let them all know what I do. Like,
yeah,
because they're just looking to trust somebody. They don't have time the other day to like
right.
start sifting through. But if man, when you're getting intimate on a mat like that, there's a lot of cuddling going on, and you know, like get to yep. know each other pretty intimately, and you know, like you build this trust pretty quick. But it was just a really cool, you know, to think back on it, like, wow, that was like. It was pretty cheap, you know, on the grand yeah. scheme of things to like for networking, but it just goes to prove the network of showing up somewhere, going to the gym and like actually talking to people instead yeah. of like putting your earbuds in and just putting your head down and walking around. Like, man, if you're a shop owner and you're trying to pick up business, just tell people, you know, but yeah. it's pretty tough because we all know you go to any family function or anywhere you go. As soon as you say you're a mechanic, everybody wants.
Yeah.
So how do you take that conversation and twist it into a marketing opportunity, you know, and become, right. become the salesman without looking like a salesman?
Yeah.
You know,
and that's going to be a hard one for me. That's my goal for this year because I'll be moving into that shop here in a month. I'll have three times more space. I'll have more parking for cars. So I'm going to be trying to get a whole lot more car count in because I can fit it. And I'm not good with being a salesman. Like, that's not me. I just try to market trust.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's hard for me to walk up to somebody and try to make a sale.
For everybody. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that ever gets easier either. It's weird. And it's extremely tough when you got to make the sale and then do the work.
Right.
I mean, right. And so having that separation, even one layer, even having somebody in there that like you got someone on flat rate, just that one level of separation where you can say, hey, why don't you bring it in? We'll get it taken care of. But then you got to trust them too, because there's that moment in time when you first hire someone that you're not sure if they're going to be able to do that job the way you want it done. So
right.
You're not confident in that sale, right? Like you're right. In the back of your mind, even though you're not actively thinking about it, you're like, look, I don't know if this guy's really going to do it. And so you got that little momentarily, that little hesitation in your sales pitch, and everyone can see right through it right away.
Right.
And so it's tough. It's really tough to like, and then even if you were the salesman, like, oh, I know I can do it, but I'm so freaking busy. And sometimes that works better because people want like, it's like,
yeah,
if you act like I'm so busy, like all of a sudden everybody starts feeding into it. It's like the rich get richer, you know, like the more money you got,
right.
The more free shit you start getting. Like,
how
does that work?
why
do all the rich and famous get free stuff? Like, well, that doesn't make any damn sense, but it does. It's just how the world goes around, you know, but. Yeah, it was always tough for me. Yeah, it's always tough for me trying to sell something when I had to do the work. Or even in the first initial stages of hiring technicians. And even though they're great, you still in the back of your mind, you're like, they're not going to do it like I am. And so, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to be that sales guy. But it's even harder to have the conversation with somebody or like try to avoid those conversations. Like, you know, if you bring it up, you know they're going to ask you about it. And you know you don't have the answer you can give them. So it's like, you know what? Just lean into it, you know, just be Mr. Sales Guy, you know, bring it in, you know?
I get in those positions and I just dread it.
Right. Like, right. Absolutely.
It's almost like when you're tagged on Facebook, like you're tagged somebody wanting a reasonable mechanic or affordable mechanic. Oh, and I get tagged. It's like, I don't want to comment. Like, I don't know.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
Like, you appreciate the tag.
Yeah.
And you love seeing your name put out there.
Especially when it's like,
but it's like
a family member.
Yeah.
Like your mom, you know.
Right.
Thanks, Mom. I love you.
Yeah, appreciate it.
But you know it's not going anywhere. It's not going to be profitable. And now you have to, like, explain yourself. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I think the biggest...
Yeah.
The biggest one for me is when I stopped getting tagged in those Facebook posts from the local stuff anyway. It was like, okay.
Yeah.
There we go. That's how you know you're not the cheapest anymore, which is a good place to be.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to be tagged with everybody that just posts pictures of their business card. Like, that's how it is here in the local Facebook groups. It's a whole bunch of pictures of business cards. And I don't know. Like, I appreciate the tags. I appreciate the advertisement, but odds are if they're looking for someone that is affordable or reasonable, seems like they use those words a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for someone cheap.
Yeah.
And I'll talk to them. You know, if they message me, I'll talk to them. I'll give them a little, I say an estimate, but it's not really an estimate. It's more like, yeah, sure, I'll have to look at your car. It'll be this much for me to look at it. I always throw the number out there first, and that seems to separate the people that expect something for free and expect to pay for quality work.
So I've begun using those as opportunities, and I've never given prices over the phone initially. Eventually you have to.
Yeah.
Being a transmission shop, like, you can't just like keep dangling this carrot to get the vehicle in, because then you're just wasting everybody's time. It's like, if you'd have told me it'd been $6,000, I wouldn't have towed my car in here. Right. So it's like,
right.
You got to set the standard. Like, it's going to be in this area. But a lot of the time with that situation you're talking about on Facebook is like a great educational time to look, let me explain to you why you don't want the cheapest guy. And let me explain to you what I'm going to do for you as a service and what I'm going to provide on the back end. And so, and it takes a lot of time, but I feel like it is a necessary evil. And I feel like it's something where it's a, you're not going to get through to everybody, but I think it's just important to educate, especially local, you know, and some guys might just blow it off and whatever, like, okay, well then that's fine. But at least, you know, at least you're understood. Like if you hear my name or hear our shop's name and hear that we're expensive, right? And that's going to happen as rates go up. It's like, oh, I'd never go there. They're way too expensive. And it's just negativity, right? And it's fine. Do what you got to do. I don't really care that much. But the more times you can explain your process, it's like, it just kind of takes a little bit of that edge off. It's like, yeah, I heard he's expensive, but I also heard, right? And just like the more times you can get it out, and it's a lot of work, but I think it's important to advocate, you know, and make people understand the auto industry is not just all cut and dry. It's not black and white. It's not a brake job is a brake job is a brake job. It's all different. And let me explain to you exactly what is different about it. Right.
Right.
I just think that's important. And a lot of people don't understand that. And I think a lot of the times when they ask how much, they just don't know what question to ask. Like,
right.
You know, and for both of us, we've never really taken a car. I've never taken a car somewhere for a repair. I don't even know what that looks like from the consumer side. What would I ask? Like, how
that was me after I opened up shop. I'm like, you know, I was asking people that I already knew beforehand, like, well, how did that look? Because I've never paid for auto repair. I don't even know what it looks like on your end.
How much is it supposed to be? What do you ask? What is the conversation like?
How much did you pay before?
Right? Another great question. And it's like, it's always like with like the dentist's office or the doctor's office, you know? And I just recently had made a doctor's appointment, and it was like that same thing where I didn't want to ask how much. I've like sold myself on my own process so much. Like I didn't want to, like, so it's like, what do you want to make an appointment for? Like, I don't know, like to do, I don't know. Can you do like a checkup or something? Can you give me like an inspection? I don't know. Well, what's wrong? Well, nothing's wrong. I just want to make a doctor's appointment because I don't have a doctor. And I just want to
come in for a service.
Yeah. Like, can you just is there an oil change I get or something like that? Like, how's this work? Is it every like 40 years or something? Wait, I don't want to do that one yet. We'll wait a few more years for that particular one. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's interesting because I can only imagine if you've had a vehicle for, you know, 10 years or so, and you haven't had anything majorly catastrophic happen, and you don't have like your mechanic you go to, what do you ask? What, like, and so the only thing you can think of is like, well, I'll just ask how much it's going to be, you know?
Yeah.
And like I said,
I think that's a lot of it.
Yeah. And I think
a lot of people will say like, oh, well, I need this on my car. Well, how do you know you need that on your car?
Know?
And I'm working through those processes, and I don't know if you talk to Lucas Underwood, but he is a smooth talker.
Yeah.
Like, I'm taking notes.
Well, all you guys with your Southern accents have like, I got a handicap because I got this California accent. So it's not smooth, you know, it's like very brunt and a blunt, and, you know, say things like hella, even though I've heard that from other people too, but
yeah.
But yeah, you got that smooth Southern accent. You can just pretty much sell anything, you know. What they say, ketchup popsicle to a woman in white gloves is like no problem, right?
Yep.
But no, it's and a lot of that too is training too. And I don't know if you've looked into any sort of coaching or training programs, but that was a game changer for me. Like getting into a coaching program, and for a long time it just seems like they're just gonna tell you to raise your rates. Just raise your rates, just raise your rates. And I think a few months in, you're kind of like, okay, I'm not really learning anything. And you look at some of the Facebook groups and you're like, I can learn the same stuff here that I'm getting taught by my coach, but it's different.
There's
a bigger network. There's a lot of other things, but the Institute's got some other ones. Like Cecil is the smoothest talker I've ever met. Like that guy, I don't know if you've ever sat in any of his classes.
No, Cecil? I haven't.
Oh, that guy is like, that his phone skills are like next level, you know? And he's got like that type of thing where he can be like talking and then go, hey, Mrs. Jones, how's everything going? And he's like, all of a sudden, like, totally different person. You're like, dude, how do you do that? And he's got an answer for everything, you know?
Yeah.
And there was a, who was I talking to? I was talking to Mike Allen. He was talking about ChatGPT, the 4.0 version, and they're using that to have like conversations. So you can hire a service advisor or yourself. You can go in there and say, hey, I want to sell you brake jobs. I want you to deny me 3 times. Or I want you to deny me 4 times. Right. And then you can do your thing. And this thing, ChatGPT will argue with you, not argue with you, but you know, you got to do a kind of a hard sell with it to try to sell this brake job. It's like,
yeah,
that's pretty cool. You know, like stuff like that, that constant friction is what makes you grow. And like getting, when people say no, and you're like, what an awkward situation. Like, yeah. I don't want to sell them any harder. I don't want to be that high pressure sales shop, but it's like,
right.
I don't know. It's, I don't even know how to like put it into words, but you kind of have to, but you kind of don't. And it's like this special skill you have to be like, well, what's the obstacle here?
Right.
What, like your vehicle is important. It's here now. If you don't do it here today, these brakes are going to start grinding and then somebody else is going to sell it to them. So you have to get that sell to make sure that that vehicle is taken care of at your shop, you know,
yeah.
not at the local fast lube or whatever, because it's going to happen. You know, it's like eventually it needs it. So it's a little bit of that too. Like if you don't take care of it, somebody else is going to. So you almost have to push that sale onto them to make sure you can do it. Even though that sounds right. Kind of a little arrogant, but
yeah,
you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, yeah. Right. But it's like the right thing to do. Cause you know, you're going to do it right. And it's going to be taken care of. And they don't want to do it because they're just looking at the money part of it. Like, look, I have to take care of your vehicle. I have to, I'm going to do it right. And it's tough, man. It's like, it's so tough to wrap your brain around that situation.
Right.
And not turn into Mr. Salesman.
I definitely need to get some coaching on my salesman, you know, my sales tactics. I'm not good with being pushy. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I don't know if you have to necessarily be pushy either. Cause it's such a, I don't know. There's so much gray area in the middle there where,
I know,
you know, you brought up Lucas and it's like, he's not pushy. He just makes it make sense.
Right. Yeah.
And that's the thing.
Smooth with the words.
You just got to make it make sense. And it's not like you're being untruthful about it or unfair about it. You're just relaxing, taking a few breaths and like, look, this is the situation. It needs it. Right. And it's like, this is your vehicle. Do you want to take care of it or not? That's the bottom line. And do you want to get towed back in here or do you want to take care of it today and not have to worry about it for the next 3 years?
Right.
I mean, the tactics are all over the place and there's tons of other companies I've seen that have the high pressure sales tactics, you know, free inspections, right? Inspect all vehicles and do it for free. And then high pressure sales, all the stuff you find. So that way you can pay your taxes. Like, no, we charge for an inspection. So vehicle comes in, we're charging like right off the gate. Like I'm charging you to look at your vehicle and then I'm charging you for what it's coming in for. That's just how we roll. And if you don't like that, then this is not the relationship we can grow on. Cause anybody else is going to do that. They're going to do the high pressure sales tactics based on of a free inspection. It's like nothing's free. Nothing.
So do you do the 300% rule or do you charge for every inspection?
Both. So I'm an advocate to charge for the inspection, but we are 100% 5Cs, 300% rule. Like that's every time. And then follow up. We have CRMs that go through and, you know, do the 15 day, 30 day, 60 day, 90 day reminders, phone calls and all that stuff. Cause if you do all that work and then you don't follow up on it, it's all for nothing. Right.
Right.
But the main thing was starting from the beginning. If we do an inspection and it's free, we have to sell something on that car. And sure, if it's me and my wife, we're going to be able to take care of that. And for the most part, 99% of guys out there that you hire or girls that you hire, they're not going to want to do that. But there's always that chance that you get to a point where you have the system in place and you're doing these free inspections and everyone's banking on their sales to make up for that free inspection. Something's going to go sideways. Like eventually someone's going to be sold something that they didn't really need because we're having a slow week or whatever. And it's like, it's not even going to be a thought. So it comes in, they get charged an hour. We do the inspection and most of the time we can solve the client's problem with that inspection because we're taking an hour and looking through every part of the vehicle. And so a lot of the time we can find what's going on, why it was there for, you know, it's got a shape going down the road. Well, we're inspecting tires in our DVIs. Hey, the tire's got a freaking bubble on the side of it. We solved the problem, right? Sometimes it's not so you know, sometimes a little more complicated than that. So we have to say, hey, we need an advanced assessment to check on the codes or whatever it ends up being. And honestly, it all comes out in the wash. So if it came in for an advanced assessment, normally it's gonna be $300 or $400 for that high level assessment. Well, if we combine the inspection with an extra hour, ends up being the same, right?
Yeah.
$400 to go 300, $400 to go through and check what it is. But also gives us the opportunity to say, hey, look, do we need to do an assessment at, say, $150 an hour? Or do we need $210 an hour because we got a CAN bus communication fault code, right? So right. It just sets the standard. And that's what we tell them every time. Look, you come in, this is just our starting point. This gets us all on the same page. It lets us know what condition the vehicle's in, what code's going on. Do we have rodent damage going on? Like, what does this car look like? Is it rusty? Like, there's so many different possibilities that it's like, I don't even know where to set your advanced assessment at because we don't even know what the car looks like yet. And you can't, for me, it was so hard to say, well, we'll just set a standard labor rate at 170 an hour. Is that fair though? Some cars need, some cars, we do a lot of classic car stuff. Those cars, they require a higher level skilled technician, right?
Yeah.
Somebody that's a little bit older that might know a little bit more. So that's going to be higher labor rate. What if it comes in and it's a freaking 2010 Honda Civic? So the brake job on that car is the same labor rate as a brake job on a 1965 Chevy Impala? I don't think so. Right. You know, it's like, so.
And the parts, finding the parts. It's going to take longer to find parts and all that they're stuff. Not as available.
Yeah. Or the Honda Civic with 80,000 miles as opposed to the Honda Civic with 210,000 miles that spent half its life in New York. Two different cars, two totally different cars, same exact year, make, model, right? Two totally different cars. So it just set the standard, but it's like, how could I ever not charge for that initial intake? It just doesn't make any financial sense to me. And I get pushback on it, sure, but we all get pushback on everything, but at least that way it filters through and it lets me know, hey, this client's here to fix their car. You know, and not just fix it, but maintain it and keep it on the road. And it's like, if they're not willing to make that initial investment with us and our company, then there's really no relationship moving forward because it's always going to be just fix what's broken. And it's like, no, I don't, I'd rather not do anything.
Right.
I'd rather just be standing around then if you don't want me to completely maintain your vehicle and keep it on the road, you know?
Yeah, I'm the same way. And it's weird as a new shop owner, like you, there's so many growing pains. Like you don't want to charge more for things. And right now I'm looking at, like you said, the effective labor rate. How much time am I spending versus what I'm charging? Mm-hmm. And right now I do the 300% rule, but I don't charge for inspections. I do it like if the job is, say I'm getting a van coming in for brakes. I'm inspecting that van while my helper is doing the brakes. But I believe that like you said, we should be charging for all of our time, but it's a growing pain for me to think about how to charge for an intake inspection. I don't even know how to word that, but it's something that I definitely want to do for sure.
I look at it as, I think the inspections take a high level skill to be able to properly look at a vehicle and know what's good and what's bad. That is not something you just are born with or you gain in a year or gain in 2 years or 3 years, maybe 3 years, maybe to get to the point where you can actually confidently look at a vehicle in a reasonable amount of time and look at all the different aspects of it and be able to call out, hey, this has got 100,000. These are the items that are probably going to be needed, right? Some of it's easy. Sure. Everyone can look at brake pads and know that they're worn out.
Right.
But do you know how to pull the plug on an all-wheel drive Honda CRV and be able to check the transfer case fluid? You know, comes to transmission levels. How many of them have dipsticks anymore? You know, so you got to look up the damn procedure to check the freaking level of the transmission fluid. What color?
Everything has a procedure.
Yeah. What color is it supposed to be? You know, is it CVT? Yeah. Is it not? Like, there's a lot of, and then even as a 20 years in, I'm still looking up like, what is this thing? Is this a CVT? Is it not? And if I'm doing that, you know, and not say like I'm on the top or by any means, but it's like, I've been doing this for a little while. And it's like, if I'm looking this up, this takes a high level of skill. Why is this free? Why is this expected?
I think a lot of times we don't think of ourselves as professionals when we are.
Oh, absolutely not. No. Imposter syndrome, right? How long does it take before you feel like you're actually the owner of the shop?
Right.
I haven't got there yet, so I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know that we ever will.
You're always just like, just learning every day, you know? And it's like, and you just think you get to a point where you're going to know and everything. But then the next year comes around and there's a whole new set of vehicles with a whole new set of different problems and different things that are in them, you know? It always reminds me, reminds me of a guy who told me years ago, he's in his late 60s now, but he said he worked for so long and he felt like he was getting so comfortable with the way automobiles were. And this was like in the late 70s. It had to be in the late 70s. He said he remembers the very first car that came in with disc brakes. And he's like, yeah, I almost rolled my toolbox out and quit because it was like, I'm not learning something new. I got this stuff down, right? He's like, had drum brake. But come to find out, it was so much easier. But it's like there's constantly something new. And I think a lot of techs have a problem with that. They think they feel like you should know everything. And that, I think that filters up to the service advisors, up to the owner. Like you're expected as a shop owner to know everything.
Right.
And it's like,
being, you know, going into being a shop owner, it made me have a different perspective. It's like when you have your first kid, you always thought your parents just knew what they were doing. You went home with a baby and you didn't know what to do with it. You know what I mean? Like you become a business owner and you just realize that all the businesses that you walked into that were small, like they were kind of winging it.
Yeah.
Maybe a calculated winging it, but they were learning as they go.
Absolutely.
And it's the same thing with shop ownership. You don't know what you're doing until you learn it. You know, I always say you don't know what you don't know until you know it.
Yeah. And you always don't know. So you're always learning.
Yeah, like somebody says, oh, I got this code from AutoZone and it says it needs this, so I need my intake. And it was just a customer that just called me and I explained to him, like, I can't say that it's the intake. I mean, from my experience, you have two codes that could be a million things.
Yeah.
So,
and how hard is it to stop to not do that as well? When you see a code and you kind of shoot yourself in the foot and you say, oh, I've seen this so many times, it's probably this. That's my problem. I overcomplicate things when I pick up the phone here in the office. It's like, I go so far into this like technical jargon that the client has no idea what I'm talking about, but nobody wants to seem like they're stupid, so they're agreeing with me. I'm like, wait, are you following me? It's like, oh yeah, absolutely. No idea. Yeah. No idea what I'm talking about. As long as I just keep rambling on, right? And that's my biggest problem, is like, I just need to shut up. Like I just need to get the damn car in the door. Just get the car here. That's my job. That's all it is. And I just can't help myself but try to help. Right. And it's like, you're not helping anymore. That's not helping. And it's like, I feel like I am. I'm giving knowledge away for free. Isn't that helping? It's like, no. Now they come in with an expectation and it's like, and you were wrong. Like, I wasn't wrong. They just didn't give me all the information. You know, it's like,
right.
Then the ego comes in and the whole thing just goes sideways and I should have just never answered the phone to begin with.
Yep.
It never works out great, you know? And I don't know, it's pulling the ego out of that and having that technician, like you said, with the EMA, technician to manager to entrepreneur, and trying to find your spot in the shop and find, well, when do I make that transition? When can I become the manager? When do I get to be the entrepreneur? And I think that's like a really difficult conversation to have with yourself. Is that what you want to do? You know, and for some, they don't. They want to be in the shop and work. Okay, well, then you need to hire those other positions. Well, I can't afford that. Well, you got to do something. And just like you said, well, I took a deep look inside and I thought, I'm not making money. So it's time to put my ego aside and start doing breaks.
Yes.
You know?
Same. 100% the same. Stop asking for the hard stuff. Stop advertising lifted trucks. Stop advertising the diag stuff. Yes, I'll still do them, but I'm advertising 3-year warranty on brake jobs.
Yep.
Like,
and you start looking at your numbers and looking at your KPIs at the end of the year, and you start realizing, hey, you know what? I'm making a lot of money on suspension work. I'm making a lot of money doing AC work. I'm doing a lot of you don't even realize it in the time because you're just doing it, right? But you have this ego and this vision of like, I want to be a diagnostic shop. I want to be a whatever shop. I want to be a transmission builder, be the best transmission builder in the county, in the country. And it's like, all of a sudden you start looking at your numbers. It's like, well, it looks like I'm doing ball joints and tie rods. That's what my shop's going to be, because that's what I'm making money doing. And it's like, it's so hard to make that transition. It's like, well, that's, you don't really get to choose. Like, whatever happens, happens. And sometimes I think you can push that buck a little bit, but when does it come to a point where, you know what? I think I made a mistake and I need to pivot.
You need to stop working. Like they always say, you need to stop working in your business and start working on your business. You got to reevaluate and pivot. And that's what this whole year has been for me, just pivoting.
So this next year, what's your vision? What's your goal? You're moving into a new shop. You got a lot of things going on. You're doing all the right things. You're on the right path. You're definitely, big things are going to happen for you. What's your end goal? Like, how do you see yourself in the next year, the next 5 years? That's the question of all questions.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm always somebody that looks 1 year and 5 years ahead, but to say what that goal is exactly, I don't know. In 5 years, I would like to be an established shop that has enough work to hire employees and be the owner, you know, manage that shop, be answering the phones, have the time to explain to customers more. Because the more that I get to talk to people, the more the trust is built and the more my shop's brand is trusted, I guess, the more that I get to talk to customers. When I'm a one-man show, it's extremely hard. And since I got this one helper, it's more than quadrupled my income. You know, like January was a record month for me. And for this year, I want to get in that new shop and get enough car count coming in that I can for sure hire one technician and have that one technician and see what our profit is at the end of the year. That's my main goal for this next year, is just get in there, hire somebody, and see if we can, you know, see how much profit we can make and then grow from there, really.
That's awesome. So you're looking at expanding your team. You want to take a role that's a little bit more divorced away from the shop, take a role more in the office, and then eventually kind of move your way into.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, me as a diagnostic guy, I can diagnose cars, but there's a lot of people out there that can put on some brakes. There's a lot of people out there that can do some ball joints, change a strut, things like that. And those people are working in shops right now that don't have AC. They might not be well lit. They might not be paid the greatest. I know when I was working at a Kia dealership, they only wanted to pay me $21 an hour flat rate. Like, that's not enough here. I can't even live on that. So I want to be the shop that can pay technicians well and not really work in the office, but help doing the diag stuff. Because there's so many things that go on behind the scenes of an auto shop that you don't even think about as a technician. You just think about turning wrenches. So I went from being a mechanic that could, you know, work 40 hours a week, turn 40 or more hours a week with warranty work, to turning like 13 to 20 hours a week because I do so much out of the scenes. Mm-hmm. You know, looking up parts, doing estimates, doing everything that it takes to run a business and educating yourself at the same time. So that's really my goal, is get a technician, you know, treat that technician well, pay him well, and see where the year takes us. And then from there, I'll know more of, okay, I might start out my technician flat rate because I don't know how much I can pay him. But once I know how much we made that year, I'll know an hourly rate that I can afford, and then benefits and things like that, and just elevate myself as an owner. Because I don't know what I don't know until I know it.
That's true. It's an awesome vision, man. I highly recommend looking into a coaching program.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I definitely want to get a coach.
You got to have money for that too, I guess. So that's a tough one. Yeah,
that's the hard part right now. Because right now, the new shop, I'm looking at two more lifts, and I'm looking for ALI certified lifts, and, you know, I'm getting signs made and I'm getting a website built. And, you know, every time I start up, it's minimal $30,000 just to open up the door. So You know, I got a shop set up before I got a divorce. I got a shop set up after the divorce, and now I'm doing another one. So hopefully this is the last one for a while.
You'll be an expert before we know it.
Oh, I know a lot about lifts.
That's par for the course, man. You got to learn. You live and you learn is what they say, I guess. And you're that's young, it. So you got it's plenty of time learning. To make it back up.
Right.
Well, right on, man. I appreciate you coming on and spending some time. It was a lot of good information, a lot of good conversation. And I think you're prepped for greatness, man. You're way beyond I ever was at the infancy.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I until this, it's been, how many years has it been? 7 years? I didn't even know any of this stuff until about a year ago.
Really?
Like the groups, the camaraderie, the networking. I mean, yeah. It took me 5 years to get my head out of my ass and like realize that we're all in this together. I was just burning the grindstone, man.
Before all the groups, I was ready to go be an HVAC tech because I had already, that was right when I found out I was $14,000 in debt and
that'll do it.
You know, I was like, well, I have to sell my car. I sold my car to a guy in California. He came all the way down here and got it. Had to sell a gooseneck trailer I had, you know, to get out of debt. And I was just like, you know, this industry, I didn't realize how bad the industry was until I became an owner. And it's like, you know, I knew that I was underpaid before, but until I seen why they were paying me so little because they were charging so little, it really put it in perspective and I was ready to get out of the industry. And I met all the people in the groups and learned everything I learned and started seeing improvements.
Started drinking the Kool-Aid and now you're stuck.
Yep.
Now you're gonna look back in 5 years like, you guys are a bunch of assholes, man. Why'd you do this to me?
Right. Yeah, should have gave me half a honey bun.
Nice.